It's that time of the week again. Welcome to Uproar in the Studio, your weekly Chinese blockbuster podcast. I'm Noah.
I'm Reza.
I'm Andrew, and this is the Jackie Chan post-Rush Hour 3 season.
I'm too excited about this episode. This week we're going to talk about The Spy Next Door, released in 2010. I saw this movie as an 11-year-old. If somehow you have not seen this movie, we're going to give a synopsis. But if you want to watch it without spoilers, listen to the show afterwards.
Later, we're joined by Brian Levant, director of The Spy Next Door, Snow Dogs, which is also the best movie ever made, Are We There Yet?, Jingle All the Way, and all the other classics from our childhood. And then we have an interview with Oscar-nominated composer David Newman, who's worked on Ice Age, The Sandlot, the live-action Scooby-Doo movies, the second and third best movies of all time, and of course, The Spy Next Door.
But first, here's our conversation about the film. It's just us this time. But at least there's a synopsis.
Jackie Chan stars as Bob Ho, a mild-mannered dude looking for long-term love with a secret double life as a super spy in this American action flick in the tradition of The Pacifier and Kindergarten Cop. After stealing a secret formula from Russian spies with his buddies George Lopez and Billy Ray Cyrus, Bob is tasked with watching his girlfriend's three children while she goes away on a business trip. Craziness ensues as Bob tries to win the affection of his girlfriend's patently uncool children while fending off wave after wave of bloodthirsty Russian operatives. In the end, Jackie gets the bad guys, including double agent George Lopez, and the children come to love and accept Jackie Chan as their new father. Cannibalism, Halloween, and flamethrower Totinos. This is The Spy Next Door.
What did you guys think of this movie?
I don't know, I saw this movie when it came out. I think I'm the only one of the three of us that saw this movie when it came out. I was like 12 years old, it was 2011, and I saw The Spy Next Door.
Oh, so you watched it like on the puberty timeline. So like you probably had lots of emotions about this one.
No, I watched this movie like as a member of its intended audience.
Yeah. I think its intended audience was 11 years old in 2001. Mm-hmm. Not like in 2010 when this movie came out. I think this movie came out about like 10 years too late because it's got a similar sensibility to like Cats and Dogs, Cat in the Hat.
Mm-hmm. Those movies Grinch. That I also watched as a child.
Right, but like those came out about a decade earlier than this one did, or like half a decade at least.
Mm-hmm.
Cat in the Hat, like, traumatized me as a child because like I bought like a bootleg of that in like fucking Queens in like Flushing, and I brought it home and all the voiceover was just like this black dude just cursing.
I mean, that's similar to my experience with the second live action Scooby-Doo movie, which was all one Russian man dubbing it. You could still hear the English underneath, but he kept saying things like jinkies and like various shit that are, you know, a middle-aged Russian man should not be saying.
That's unfortunate. Like, that's a great movie.
It had Seth Green as the villain.
So let's talk about this garbage fire of a movie.
Well, was that your reaction when you were like 12?
No, when I was 12, I was having the time of my life. I was like, oh, I don't know who this guy is.
I'm 24 and I had the time of my life last night. That was fucking great.
I had fun watching it. Yeah, no, I definitely had fun watching it. It is still a very strange movie.
It's very weird, but I don't know if it's fair to say that it is bad. I don't think...
A lot of critics would disagree with you.
We okay. are the only critics that matter.
A, correct. B, I'm pretty sure Jackie Chan would also probably disagree with me. Like, if you look at the blooper reel on this movie, like, I just watched, I watched Armor of God and Operation Condor last night. Mm-hmm. And in both of those movies, Jackie Chan had, like, some really awful injuries, which they include in the bloopers. Like, he had a moment, which he also describes in his book, where literally his brain was spilling out of his head.
Jesus.
Yeah. He fell out of a tree and was attacked by, I think, a leopard. If you mm-hmm. look at the bloopers for this one, it's literally just them screwing up lines. There are no stunt mm-hmm. mistakes, and there's no Jackie Chan goofing around, even though this is one of the longer blooper reels I've seen on a Jackie Chan movie. This is just not a fun movie to make.
It was nice to see him. I think in the bloopers in this one, it kind of just showed that he just didn't really want to be there at all, you know?
Right, like, exactly.
<yeah. laughs> I mean, it just feels like they tried to get a bunch of people because the star power in this movie is so weirdly placed.
Yeah.
Bro, when the first scene with like Jackie Chan, Billy Ray Cyrus, and George Lopez happened, I actually thought I was ascending.
Exactly. It's like that's all the star power of this movie, plus the like Icelandic Olympian that made Lazy Town as the bad guy. But
like the only person Icelandic? Missing, like Lil Nas X.
Yeah.
Again, I think this movie, he was probably like 12 when this came out, too.
Really?
Or younger.
Actually, yeah.
It's possible that Lil Nas X is younger than you are now.
I think he might be.
He is younger.
How old is he? Yeah.
April 9th, 1999 is Lil Nas X's birthday.
April 9th. So he's like a month younger than me.
Nice.
God damn, you're a 99 baby?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Thanks.
Okay, so can we talk about how the kids in this fucking movie are real fucking weird?
Who's your favorite kid?
I mean, I think the like spook kid, the like, because they obviously all grew up in a suburb of Langley, Virginia, and they're all fucking like mini Pete Buttigieg's, which will be an outdated reference.
I'm almost
but
certain that the son was like Charlie Kirk.
Sure.
The son to me felt like
Turning Point vibes.
The son for me felt like he was a Spencer Breslin knockoff.
I don't know that reference.
Spencer Breslin? Spencer Breslin was the kid in The Cat in the Hat.
Oh, I mean, I literally haven't seen that movie since I was a kid in theaters. And
oh my god. He's the Breslin that got away. There's Abigail Breslin and there is...
I've heard of Abigail Breslin.
Yeah, of course. There's another one, too. Fuck, we have to cut this, too, if we get the kid. This is all going to depend on... what we include here is going to depend on which actor we get.
We can insult all the rest of that.
His character was actually, like,
his character was insane!
He got fucking dunked in the trash, and this probably middle schooler? Early middle schooler was shouting about, you will be hearing from my lawyers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? I mean, these fucking ops in training, you know? These fucking, like, fucking kid narcs, essentially.
Yeah.
So I have him written down as my notes as little Charlie Kirk vibes. Baby Elon Musk deserves unlimited wedgies X. Oh, man, I don't know, man. He was something.
I do want to note that their family has a house pig.
They do. Yes. They have a house pig, a house turtle, and a house cat that the mom clearly does not give two shits about.
But it sleeps with the little kid.
Leaves it on the roof.
It sleeps with the little kid, so it gets a little bit of love.
Yeah, from the little kid, but the mom literally left that cat on the roof to fend for itself. And Jackie Chan had to stunt his way up there to save it.
That was probably one of my favorite stunts, actually, getting when he just saves the cat.
I mean, it was just like a little bit of wire work. I don't know.
Yeah. But like, it was just so like wholesome.
Yeah.
Like Jackie Chan saving the cat from the roof.
I mean, the gratuitous stunts are what make this more of like, even though it's obviously made by entirely like Americans, the gratuitous stunts and like just sometimes the weird sense of humor are what make this more of a Jackie Chan, like almost a classic Jackie Chan movie, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, this movie goes into some fucked up places, though. Like, I know that this wasn't the biggest thing, this is more of a throwaway joke, but when he feeds the pet pig bacon, it was also just like...
Wait, I totally missed that, but like, that's amazing.
And then, like, having to explain to the baby, like, why that's wrong.
Yeah, and also, why do you even eat bacon if you have a pet pig?
I mean, that goes into all sorts of questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I could own a dog.
No one should eat bacon. Dog.
The other thing is the oldest daughter, Farron, her character backstory was just so horribly sad.
What? Yeah. Oh, that she was, like, not even the mother's daughter and, like, abandoned by her father?
Just confused why she was calling, you know, the mom by her first name. But then I just assumed that's a white people thing. But then there was backstory.
Like an American kid thing. But on the point of all the kids being narcs, you know, agency narcs in training, when he's, like, climbing up on the roof with her and he's like, can I sit there with you? She's like, it's a free country, which is the most fucking like narc child thing.
I lost my shit when she said that.
Like, God.
I was like, yeah, libertarian.
She's a mini Ron Paul. Just up there. It's a free country. The coronavirus is a hoax. Fucking God. Oh, can we talk about George Lopez and fucking Billy Ray Cyrus?
I don't know why he was in this movie.
Which one?
I couldn't put my finger on it.
So I'm assuming this was like the golden age of his career, right? When he's like the dad in Hannah Montana.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
I don't know about anything about Billy Ray Cyrus's early career. I assume he had like a
one...
He was
just a country music singer.
He was
like
one
country music hit or something, and then...
Yeah.
On to Disney.
I think he was pretty like big.
Popularized the mullet.
I mean, I'm just glad that there's a whole generation of like Americans who only know him as the Lil Nas X rapper.
Or the guy tweeting about his vault of like weed.
I feel like a big overlap with that generation is the guys who know him as Hannah Montana's dad.
Well, that's that's like me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. But you also know him as the Lil Nas X guy.
Yeah, but that seems like that feels like slightly more removed. Like, people my sister's age, like still in high school or whatever, probably have never watched Hannah Montana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But have.
And like shouldn't.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's playing anywhere. You'd have to seek it out at this point.
Probably Disney Plus.
Oh, it's definitely on Disney Plus.
Sure. But I don't mean it's like. I don't think Hannah Montana is the sort of thing you watch if you're not, if it's not being aired in front of you, you know?
If you're like,
I used to wait
liked it.
With my younger sister back in the day, man. Great, great, just incredible television.
Yeah, think of all the stars
like
that started the career.
Or True Detective.
We're just not talking about the movie.
The screenwriting in general was just like really, really bad. Like really, really bad.
Wrote Unsane, which is a Steven Soderbergh movie that I heard was really good, which is why I'm so confused as why the people who are writing a psychological thriller in 2018 are writing this weird children's movie.
I mean, to be fair, the guy who wrote the Hangover movies wrote Chernobyl.
That is true. Yeah.
Got a lot of versatility out there.
Yeah, I mean, some people are good at it, and some people are just, like, doing shit until they get a hit, or not even a hit, but, like, have a mild success with an iPhone movie.
Or, I mean, maybe in the case of Chernobyl, if you just had a different director behind it, it would be exactly like The Hangover.
Oh, God.
Yeah, Mike Tyson, like, in the reactor.
Yeah, you literally just switch the directors. I mean, honestly, Todd Haynes doing Chernobyl would be at least interesting. I watched his G.G. Allen documentary a while back, and... God,
I don't know what to say. I haven't seen the documentary.
Oh, it's a man like throwing shit at people quite literally as a concert.
Nice.
Yeah. Yep. He just falls around. Yeah.
That's what I call art.
I think so. I think that's what Todd Haynes certainly calls art.
This movie is a much less visceral form of art than that.
It's a lot like Mary Poppins. This movie, I think. He doesn't have an umbrella, but
he does
magic.
Have a flamethrower.
Right. He does,
that
like,
cooks
agent
toast.
Magic.
Actually, you're right. I did think of Mary Poppins, and I do think this is, like, this movie's kind of a tribute to Mary Poppins in a way.
Yeah, it's like a mix between Mary Poppins and Are We There Yet?
Yeah, except nobody was trying to kill the kids in Mary Poppins.
I think the villains in this movie had, like, the best kind of...
wardrobe?
You know, intentions. Like, it was kind of like a Russian Green New Deal sort of vibe, right? Like, just get rid of oil everywhere else in the world. So,
I mean,
like,
it's kind of what the Kremlin tried to do recently,
it's kind
drop
of
the
did.
Oil price massively, but they fucked themselves and the rest of us.
No, but you gotta love Russian foreign policy because, like, as long as everybody else is fucked, it doesn't matter how fucked you yourself are.
I mean, at this point, yeah, that's pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would have been less the case around 2010, but it does very prophetically predict the position of the, you know, Russian state today.
Yeah, I also feel like it's weird that the movie just did not at all address any of the environmental potentials of
dissolving all the oil.
Well, it's just like if you have an oil spill and you dump the shit in it, it's just like it's fixed.
Yeah,
no, but that's not, you know. That's not what they're going for. They're going for world oil market domination.
Yeah.
Apparently the U.S. is buying
and
up,
generally,
like
the what? Russians in this movie were just so, like, insufferable, where, like, nobody's accent was consistent for more than 3 seconds.
I wasn't massively annoyed by the accents, I gotta be honest.
It was pretty awful, bro.
I enjoy a bad Russian accent. I'm still, like, very much a supporter.
Red Sparrow.
I haven't seen Red Sparrow, but I do very much like Alan Arkin in The Russians Are Coming. The Russians Are Coming. We're here to talk to you about boats. Boats.
Have y'all seen 2010, The Year We Made Contact?
I've seen Contact.
It's the sequel to 2001.
Oh,
and Space Odyssey.
Yeah. Huh. And half of the cast is doing a really shitty Russian accent.
Yeah, unlike in Wandering Earth, where the Russians speak perfect Russian.
Yeah.
What a movie.
But that's the thing for me. It's just like, don't just have people speak English in a Russian accent. Just have them speak Russian. Just do it. Like,
well,
why?
I mean, it's a kid's movie.
At one point, just like really like slightly saying, duh.
No, you're right. Children can't read.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
I'm just speaking generally.
The children in this movie definitely can't read.
Yeah, that one
kid.
That boy
was reading astrophysics textbooks.
No, Jackie Chan picks that up and he's like, do they assign this to you in school?
That's
and
my pleasure.
Just some light.
Exactly.
Reading.
No, totally. That is like Pete Buttigieg claiming to have read Finnegan's Wake. Same shit.
Oh, yeah.
Same shit. I wish
Pete Buttigieg was on camera saying he's read Finnegan's Wake.
I think he's in a print interview saying that. What do we think of the possibility that this was actually just an extended TV pilot?
I don't think that Jackie Chan would ever do TV. Or do you think it was just written as a TV pilot and then...
A, Jackie Chan has not technically done TV, but he was the star of an animated series where another guy...
I watched that animated series. Oh,
that show was so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like Mike Tyson Mysteries before Mike Tyson...
Less tongue-in-cheek.
Right. Well, not even massively less tongue-in-cheek, though.
Well, the thing is, by virtue of its very existence, it wasn't tongue-in-cheek.
No, I totally used to run home from school, like, to watch that TV show.
Yeah.
It would play, like, around the same time as, I don't remember what the fuck it was called.
Shaolin Showdown?
That's it. That is it.
Ooh, wow. Good times.
Jackie Chan is, like, very much part of our childhoods, but this movie came out, like, too late, I think, at least for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this movie was for us.
It would have been, like, in the same... I don't know. I think it's when he realized that children were watching his movies. But this is, like, heavily leaning into, I'm making a children's movie. It's like...
Well, it is a children's movie.
No, exactly. It's the Kindergarten Cop of Jackie Chan's career.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you put it that way, it definitely would be. I'm just wondering how this movie came into being, though.
Any theories?
I really genuinely am.
Well, you know, Jackie Chan had some stock in, like, a pen exporting company.
Very possible.
Or in the CIA.
Or in Hyundai. He was driving a Hyundai.
Well, you know how we have, like, this is going to be in a much later episode than this, but when we had, you know, The Foreigner, when we did the conversation with David Marconi, we got a very good sense of, like, the progression of how that movie came into being.
But how could this one work with anyone but Jackie Chan? Who are you going to put in this? Fucking Matt Damon?
Well, it was definitely made as a Jackie Chan vehicle.
Exactly. Like, literally, I don't... And, like, literally the opening mm-hmm. montage is... A lot of the shots are from Armor of God and Operation Condor for some reason. But, like...
Yeah.
Just, it, like, a montage of his career up to then.
Do you think that Arnold could have done this movie? I mean, I know he's way too old. Because at least, I know Jackie Chan's, like, older, but he still looks young. He looks passably, like, he could play 50 or 40.
I feel like Jackie Chan can always look 50.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the right amount of makeup. Although, when he's really young, like, Armor of God is 86.
Hmm.
I don't know if he could have aged up.
No, probably not age up. But I'm just thinking, like, is there anybody else who this movie could have been made for? Or do we think there was definitely just a Jackie Chan vehicle that somebody was asked to write?
Again, who else are you going to cast? Tom Cruise?
I mean, it just couldn't have been Tom Cruise. It can't be somebody...
Because there's no warmth in a Tom Cruise performance ever.
No.
He's never successfully played warm. He's played like psychopathic.
I don't know. Eyes Wide Shut.
So warm. Such a happy marriage in that movie.
No, in Jackie Chan's movies, he just doesn't seem to take himself.
I don't know. Did I misinterpret that movie?
I don't think we should get into it.
But it's something that it makes him unique with action stars, that he is so like whimsical in his own stuff, even when he's doing it.
I would watch a movie of this where it is Jason Statham. It would be bad. It would be worse. And like Jackie Chan can play the like happy family movie. Jason yeah. Statham would be so out of place. It would be funny. Or Vin Diesel. Vin Diesel could do this.
Well, Vin Diesel already did it. Vin Diesel did The Pacifier.
I didn't see it.
Oh, that was such a good movie.
Because this movie really is just that. That was this like movie the same is. Movie. Kindergarten Cop's movie is The Pacifier. It's just that Wait, those things with Jackie Chan.
The same movie.
Exactly.
Damn. Is he CIA?
Basically, yeah.
I also love that Jackie Chan is just called Bob throughout this movie.
Yeah.
Bob Ho.
His name isn't Bob.
Right.
But yeah.
I have to tell you something.
What a cliffhanger.
Really?
Did you guys notice Billy Ray Cyrus's face during that like scene?
I love that
like,
Billy Ray Cyrus is his best man. I loved that so much.
He just was like looking at like the clock, I think, behind the camera.
When do I get to leave? Why am I not high yet today?
He had a Hannah Montana shoot to get to after this. He was just trying to. He was counting the minutes.
And like the last thing he says to Jackie Chan is like something about like. Maybe, like, we had misunderstandings in the beginning because of the language barrier.
Oh, yeah, he just said, like, chalk it up to the language barrier.
Which, like, at first I was like, he didn't actually say that, right? Because I actually had to watch that twice.
Yeah. No, he did. I heard it, too.
Again, my memory of this movie is somewhat blotted out by various quarantine-related factors. I do remember him having a very brown coat in like the action climax, essentially, when he runs in. His coat is like, it's not dark enough to be a regular coat, it's like chocolatey brown. Very strange.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't either.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I don't know, his coat made an impression on me, Billy Ray Cyrus.
But his character's, like, career CIA, right? Because his mom was, like, stationed in East Berlin, just, like, yeah, one of those many, like, strange lines that were just, for some reason, put into this.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why he was born in East Berlin, I guess. So I don't know why he has a Southern American accent.
I think he was raised entirely on Dolly Parton records.
Probably.
That's how he learned English.
He's also, like, only marketable because of the way he speaks.
Man.
Can we talk about, like, I don't think we've sufficiently covered George Lopez's... Yeah.
He comes in... So, the first shot of him is in, like, the fake Langley, like, station, right? Mm-hmm. And then the second time we see him, he's the mole, like, 50 minutes later.
Yeah, and then he gets his finger bit by that turtle.
So, he's only in the movie for, like, 8 minutes.
He wasn't really good at pretending to be the good guy.
No, but he does have that moment where we're like, where Jackie Chan's like, "No, I'm sorry, I'm quitting. This is my final mission. I insist." And then he's like, "But every little boy wants to be a spy, you know." So that
and
was
that
kind of endearing.
Quickly transitions into like, "I'm about to make billions from the Russians."
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I felt like billions was a little too much.
Oil, dude. Oil.
Early 2010s, billions.
I mean,
no,
he's
guy,
about to.
No, okay, so like if this movie came out around the same time as, say, an Austin Powers, when it should have come out around the turn of the millennium, then, you know, billions would be too much. But it came out in 2010. I think billions is reasonable.
Yeah, this is the commodity boom, man. This is Chavismo time.
I don't Makes know if we want to explain that to people.
No, it's an easy Google, and, you know,
okay.
It'll make everybody feel good when they Google it.
Maybe the last thing to talk about is the aesthetic of the Russians here, because I do like the guy who keeps buying him costumes. Like, the last costume he buys him before he gets shot is basically Woody from Toy Story.
He bought him Billy Ray Cyrus's wardrobe.
Yeah, both the flannel and the cowboy outfit.
Maybe it. That was a part of his contract. He got to use my clothes.
maybe they were, like, trying to set him up as a red herring. Like,
weird running gag.
It was really funny, though. I laughed out loud multiple times at that. And also the, like, weird, like, kind of sparkly blue classic car.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why the fuck are they driving that?
What about the, what the hell is the point of, so the kid, like, downloading the secrets onto his iPod?
Well, that's what set everything off.
Yeah.
Like, that was so stupid.
Because they were alerted that a download happened.
So is the kid, like, a metal fan?
I don't know, because later on he was, like, a David Bowie and Iggy Pop concert from China in the 1980s, hot dog. And I'm like, what the who the Chan fuck does this kid know?
Yo, wait, no, that's kind of awesome, though. David Bowie and Iggy Pop concert, that sounds fun.
I mean, I would totally. You're a 40-year-old in dad, Shanghai. But this kid is 11 and he's trying to look cool in school by having concerts on his iPod.
Yeah.
He went from being like extremely like Pete nerd to like, dude, like just stop wearing your collar like that. What is going on?
No, I think that's Jackie Elon Chan's Musk doing though.
He is Elon Musk and Pete Buttigieg and Charlie Kirk.
And also maybe like Julian Assange thrown in there for like the, you know, stealing decently cool music.
That's what Julian Assange is known for, stealing that decently cool music.
Of all those people, he seems the most likely to do so. I would love to see what Edward Snowden is pirating as well. Because of course he's, I'm sure that man pirates lots of things.
I mean, he's in Russia, right? So that's like how streaming works?
Yeah, exactly. That's how people watch things.
And I'm just glad that Jackie Chan got to like sing on this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He did, and it was really sweet. It was really sweet when Jackie
like
Chan
his lullaby
singing.
Put the cat to sleep, which was beautiful.
Yeah.
It's one of the least like sort of shoehorned in Jackie Chan singing moments. Like a lot of the time it's like they've literally just cut in like a music video into the middle of the movie, but this one it's like it's a lullaby. That's fine. It's kind of cute.
And like the dumb girl like tells him he loves her. Tells him he loves her. Yeah.
She's 4.
She was insufferable.
I don't know. I enjoyed those little bits. I like the bit where he's like, he throws her. It was one of the most Cat in the Hat
that
moments
was great.
Where
was
he
great.
Throws
yeah.
her up and like she falls into the like night dress thing.
He just tried to make her too cute, you know, like too many speech impediments.
She seemed like a Who from the Grinch, you know,
I
down
think
in
that,
Whoville.
Honestly, I think that might have just been her.
Chan also kind of like shoehorned in his like origin story into this.
Oh yeah, the
it was his own origin story. You mean
like
yeah, basically
being away from his family, like being stuck in, you know, opera school, orphanage, whatever. But
yeah.
Like, yeah, that was interesting.
Family. That was pretty touching.
I mean, I don't know if I really found any of this touching, but.
I thought it was fine. I thought it was a nice movie. Nice enough movie.
Yeah. Like, not like, something I would have paid to watch, but, like, something I would have watched on FX.
Thanks for the subject matter expertise, Noah.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Reza. You know so much, man. It's crazy.
Thanks, Andrew. You know, it was just it was awesome to have you here. Up next is our interview with Brian Levant, director of The Spy Next Door.
Actually, I think, apart from one recording that kind of got screwed up for technical reasons, you're the first director on the show.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Hopefully not the last. Well, we'll see how this goes. It might kill it for everybody.
Well, at least it'll be interesting, whatever happens. Right. Can we start with your background with Jackie Chan movies? Did you grow up on his Hong Kong stuff?
No, I had seen pieces of it. I'm more a comedy person than a pure action person. And my movie going has always reflected that. But, you know, I nevertheless, the things I have seen him in, so much of the things that I see from him that put him in a very rare league, and that would be among the great silent comedians of all time, the Harold Lloyds, who did thrill comedy, and Chaplin, who, if you look at especially like his early Mutual films, the physicality is much more important than the heart and soul that came later in the feature films of the 20s and into the 30s there, and into The Great Dictator, which killed off the little tramp. And that's what I admired the most about him, you know, that the opportunity to work with him presented itself to me as like my last chance to work with one of the great silent comics. Unfortunately, The Spy Next Door, he had to speak a lot as well. Bob Simons, who produced the film, we'd done a couple projects together, including my first film, Problem Child 2, Audience Zero. Yeah, that was successful. I don't denigrate it. I loved it. You know, when Bob suggested it to me, I wanted on board very badly. And even if it was worth going through the craziness that did follow, that we're very fortunate that Jackie was looking for a project. I think he respected Bob's track record. I have no idea if he had any awareness of my work whatsoever. And I was so fortunate to go to Beijing to meet him. I was shooting the Scooby-Doo reboot in Vancouver at the time and said, guys, I got to go for a couple days. And we were supposed to spend like a week together, and we ended up having one meal. And he said, yeah, fine, let's do it. And I flew back to Vancouver and made the other movie. And while we were in post, I started commuting 4 days a week to Albuquerque, where I went to college, actually, and knew the town very well, luckily for scouting. Otherwise, I would have been way behind the eight ball on that one. Really burning the candle at both ends, prepping one movie, finishing the other. And then Bob Simons announced, we have to go into production like a month early. I go, what? He goes, the studio, what was that studio? They're no longer Relativity. Relativity. He felt that they were going down the tubes and might pull the plug. So he wanted to make the movie before they had that opportunity, which is a very inauspicious way to begin a production. I did over 400, my name's on over 400 episodes of TV before I ever took a meeting in the movie business. And so, you know, no lead time and no prep is, you know, that's business as usual for me, usually. So we launched into what was incredibly just a 33-day shoot. With no second unit, and I had the most incredible experience I have ever had with another human being, really, because I was just so stunned by the depth of his talent, the depth of his humanity, the depth of his decency, the depth of his kindness. He was just an amazing joy, one of the great human beings who's currently walking the earth, I believe. And it was just a privilege and an honor. And I had a great time with his stunt team, his head guy, Wu Gong. I mean, we'd play on Sundays, we'd play volleyball. And one day the prop man brought a ping pong table to the set. And Jackie and I played fierce ping pong for hours. And I got there, and I couldn't take a game off. You know, you get them like 19-18, and bam, you lost 21-19.
One of those guys.
Get them 19-14, you'd lose 21-19. But, you know, and then the next day, Bob Simons had the ping pong table dismantled and destroyed. But, you know, it was such a great experience. you know, staging and creating the fight scenes. The way he prepares it and executes it expertly and well thought out and completely improvisationally as well. That he knows where he's going, and as he goes, that's how he wants to chop it up to shoot it. It's like Hitchcock, really, when he gets into this stuff. And he really takes the helm, you know, when he's hitting someone, you know, what am I going to tell him, right? He's like Hitchcock in that there's no extra film. He knows exactly how long, and maybe this is defensive filmmaking, that he's so used to having directors ruin his stuff that he doesn't give them anything extra to work with. But he and I were very much in tune and, you know, and handed off those responsibilities like we were playing catch. You know, and it was fun. And one of the things that I tried to do was usually, you know, he fights and it's his stunt team who are in other costumes and stuff that he's fighting with, right? And that's the way it is with most action people. But, you know, they're all about the same size and things like that. And I wanted to see him fight a different kind of opponent. So we cast as the henchmen, and there were many in this film because we got to just keep dispatching them. I mean, one was 7 feet tall. Another one was 6'8". Another one is 6'7". Another one is 6'6". Big men, big, agile, athletic men, you know, guys who played college football and basketball. And I wanted to see him have to fight a different way. And that inspired him. I wanted to see him. I'm always looking for, when I do watch his films, I'm looking for how he uses props as weapons.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to rearm his arsenal a little bit. And, like, we gave him a kid's bike to fight with. You know, we gave him a belt that turns into a sword so that we could literally have a sword fight across an oil refinery. Because I'd never seen him do that. Although I haven't seen a lot of the period stuff, mind you. You know, fighting inside the house, in a kitchen, you know, pots and pans and plates, improvisation, things that made it look like it just was spontaneous. And yeah, that's what you do. That's the right choice there. And it was great fun and so inventive, you know, and he's so creative and his team is so accomplished. And here, you know, we're in the CGI world. At this point, and you don't have to, they don't have to hang people on piano wires that you go over with black magic markers so they become invisible. So they're so low tech, they just put a thing in the ceiling, run a rope through it, and put it on, attach it to a harness, and pull them up, you know, right there. It's also simple. You know, our joke was, you know, Jackie didn't get out of bed without a wire. He did get hurt a couple times, very badly. Not very. I mean, nothing more than a couple of minutes. Oh, geez. Oh, I'm sorry. You okay? Yeah. Let's keep going. You know, I mean, he puts himself out there and tries to do the amazing things.
So, what was his vision of the movie like? Did it differ a bit from what you initially maybe looked for?
You know, we had a wonderful relationship. He trusted me. I think he told me that he found me different than most directors who he found sat around on the phone all day. And I was very deep and always have been deeply involved in every aspect of every moment and every facet of production. And he respected that. He's a hard worker. You know, if a couch needed to be moved on the set, he'd jump in and move it with the prop people. You know, at the end of the day, he'd go around collecting the empty water bottles and recycle them. And the ones that there was water left in them, he'd pour them all into one, go outside and water the bushes. You know?
At least the fourth person to tell us that.
Yeah.
Like different sets. He does
Everybody
this.
Loves it.
Yeah. What does that tell you? What does that tell you about every other star in the world? You know, there's a sense of discipline and purpose there. Beyond, I'm just doing my job. He's invested in the quality of the project and the quality of the people that he works with, and he expects them. And he was incredibly, incredibly generous. He is the first person I have ever seen who took an entire crew out for dinner And when we did that, he quickly discovered that he had overwhelmed the small staff of this Chinese restaurant that he liked. And so him and his guys jumped in, and they became the waiters, and they cleared the table. You know, and every week, you know, on Friday nights, on most film sets I've ever worked with and on TV shows, on Friday nights, they pass around the bucket, and you write your name on a $5 bill, and someone pulls out one of them, and you win what's ever in. Jackie donated a minimum of $500 every week, and a couple times, $2,000.
Wow.
Now, once again, you don't see people, stars, who, you know, yeah, so some guy might drop 100 in or a couple 20s or something. But once again, it's just an example of his generosity. Yes, he was making a lot of money, but he wanted to show the crew that he appreciated what they did, and it was a boost to everyone, energy and commitment, when you see your leader giving of himself in that way, and in so many ways. And on the last day of the shoot, Jackie had the lighting guy set up a couple of lights, and anyone who wanted to take a picture with him, the unit photographer took them of everybody, myself included, and him. You just ask yourself, who else does this? Nobody does this. Nobody does this. Nobody is like that. Nobody appreciates what other people would like to have in their relationship with someone of that stature. And the other things I learned about him was, number one, an incredibly savvy businessman. That my best examples of that are when he was doing Shanghai Noon in the sequel up in Alberta, Canada, in the Canadian Rockies. He saw that most of the crew was wearing North Face, you know, heavy weather gear. Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chan went out and bought the rights for Hong Kong and China of North Face.
Wow.
We shot in an empty shopping mall, so we had to dress the stores. And one of them was a local business that made giant beanbag chairs. You know, their ad said, you know, all their marketing, so the family can lie there and watch TV on the floor. Really, they're for screwing. but saw those, and that was on a Thursday. By Sunday, he owned the rights. And, you know, he loved to shop. On the weekends, he'd go to Santa Fe from Albuquerque, just, you know, 55, 60 miles away. And cleaned out a number of art galleries and loved to go to Costco and places like that and get things you couldn't get in China, you know, Tupperware kind of things and kitchen tools. Thing. And he literally went back home with two containers. He flew home with filled with all kinds of stuff.
Wow.
And on the flip side of that, what I learned was that he was the first person to do any private charity relief work, that working in the United States, and he sees the response to things like Sandy and Katrina, that people pitch in, they donate money. Well, that didn't exist in China, which is a state-run state. And so he introduced, after the terrible earthquakes in China, he introduced private charity and did fundraising and probably a telethon, things that he'd seen here, and applied those methods there to help people. And, you know, once again, I don't know how happy the government might have been about that. It kind of usurps their role, or hopefully they saw it as being assisted and were proud of people for contributing. But like I said, no one had done that before. You know, he just does a lot for people. You know, he's wonderful to his team. He doesn't let them eat a lot. They're always, you know, he wants to keep them thin. But, you know, they all eat together and they work out together. And then they go home, and Jackie goes home and he washes his socks every night.
How did you find that out?
Wu Gong told me, I think. You know, but it goes back to, you know, growing up, you know, in an orphanage and stuff, where you took care of your things and you didn't, you know, leave it to other people.
you know, this movie, it feels like it's really built around Jackie Chan. It feels like there's really nobody else who could be playing that role. And I was wondering how early on was this going to be a Jackie Chan movie? And was that, like, really embedded?
I couldn't say. Like I said, mm-hmm. I didn't come on until a couple months before we started. And the script was written by Gregory Poirier, who is not a comedy writer. He is, a drama and action writer. And, we had to change some stuff, but maybe not enough. it also got very word heavy when I would have preferred just more coast-to-coast action. You know, I think what attracted him to it was really the fact that he had never done a family film, so to speak. Mm-hmm. He had never actually worked with children. He did a film once, he said, with an 18-month-old baby. I don't think you were doing many scenes with the baby. And he was wonderful with the kids. They loved him. I think he cried when he said goodbye to the little girl. pretty sure. And he seemed to get a kick out of it. On the other hand, him and Amber Valletta, their chemistry never quite really clicked. I don't know who's at fault there or if anyone is. We could have had Courtney Cox. We just didn't have the money. If I had got Courtney Cox, I would have lost 3 days of shooting. So what would that be? And I love the kids. And, if you see the gag reel in there, he's having fun with them.
It's interesting, though, because Jackie wrote in his autobiography about having been a neglectful father to his own kid. Do you think he was sort of trying to rekindle that possibility of being a good father on this film?
Well, I don't know if it's that deep, but certainly he laid bare a gentle sweetness that I don't think we normally associate with him, especially with the little 5-year-old girl. That the kindness and the way he looked at her was authentic and genuine.
So this movie seems to fit into a slightly earlier era of family movies. I think more like Snow Dogs and Are We There Yet? Personally, Snow Dogs, I think, is the movie I've seen more times than any other movie, and it's just this.
I'm so sorry. People say that to me. It's about Jingle All the Way, and that's another head shake.
Well, we're a little bit younger than that.
No, thank you.
As a follow-up to that, I mean, this movie seemed like it felt a lot like those older movies. Do you think this movie came out just a little too late for the maybe targeted audience?
I think it probably came out a few years after they basically did the same movie with Vin Diesel, Disney.
Yeah.
But yeah, but it's in that school, Kindergarten Cop, and Are We There Yet? And most of my movies have been the actors that I've gotten along really the best with are all like me. It came from sports backgrounds. Arnold and Cuba Gooding Jr., an amazing athlete. We'd go to lunch, he'd start skipping rope, right? Come back from lunch, he's still skipping rope. And then going out all night to strip clubs. How does he do it? I don't know. and Ice Cube, and even John Goodman, and Ed O'Neill, people who were kind of jocks and want to approach things like, yeah, let's give it a try. Sure, let's try it. Rather than people, I had a couple meetings with Steve Martin, and we never really clicked because everything with him is such a thoughtful, slow process. And like I said, I'm from, come on, let's give this a try. Come on, come on, come on. It's 10,000 an hour. Let's move. And Jackie was into that. He really was. That's the way he likes to work. He'd tell us stories. In Hong Kong, he'd make movies. They'd shoot 12 hours, get a new crew, shoot 12 more hours, just go all day, all night, never stop for weeks. So that's what made it fun and spontaneous. And the fact that we had to shoot 90 some odd pages in 33 days, and given the complexity of our set pieces and the physicality of them, it was the only way it could be done. And everybody else had to follow along. And, you're always battling kid hours and it was the winter when this is a movie. I believe there's one night scene in the movie. And here every day was getting shorter and shorter and shorter.
What was it like directing Jackie Chan in the more dialogue-heavy sections of the film?
Well, you know, let's be brutally honest. His English, it's his second language, mm-hmm. or third, I believe.
Or fourth, maybe. Even.
Yeah, maybe. And he works very, very hard with it. And he had a wonderful woman from Oakland who would prepare him and literally hold out his dialogue. So he had it there off camera. But nothing like fancy cue cards. Just write it on a legal pad, you know, with a magic marker and hold it up. And he worked that way. And like I said, the film was a little too dialogue heavy for him, and it made it a little more frustrating. But it's a challenge to him, and he demands a lot of himself, and he demands success. We gave him the room to work it out, and tried to help him with the best performance that we could possibly get, given the words, the schedule, and every other mitigating factor. Like I said, had we had, like people traditionally have, things, one of the things you lose these days, as opposed to 20, 30 years ago, was readings and rehearsals, where you could see maybe where things could have been tightened and rehearsed them and learned and improved and helped. These days, you arrive, the cast arrives, they get a wardrobe fitting, you know, they get off the plane at 3, by 5 they're in a wardrobe fitting, and you're shooting the next day, and that is to the detriment of the product. The Flintstones, for instance, we had a week of rehearsals. We rehearsed every scene in the movie, many of them in the sets and on the locations where they were shot. Elizabeth Taylor came in. You know, and on Are We There Yet? We had a reading. You know, you discover that the 8-year-old boy isn't doesn't read very well. It can memorize. You know, it kind of takes the air out of it, you know. But, you know, you learn things in that process that might have benefited us in the long run. Not that I think that, you know, it's bad. It's just what I've learned in 46 years in the industry now is never to be satisfied, even when you're done with the film 10 years ago.
I'm just also wondering, just because some of the other people we've talked to have talked about, you know, Jackie Chan, after doing so many stunts over so many years, says, you know, he can't do the same sort of stuff he did when he was back doing movies like Police Story. So I'm just wondering, how was he doing physically when he was working on this movie?
So Jackie was 50, 57, 58, something like that. It was just his birthday the day before yesterday, wasn't it? Yeah,
yeah, yesterday.
So.
Yeah, exactly, yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. So, and this was 10 years ago. So how old was he yesterday?
He's turning
66. Okay, so he's in his mid-50s. So we did a scene in a gymnastics class, right? You know, he just walks over to the pommel horse and just lifts his leg up and puts it on top of the pommel horse. Now, I could do that with wires. But, you know, it's like, if you remember the scene where he slid down the escalator, you know, on the rails on either side, he kind of pulled his hamstring doing that. I just saw the film. Strangely enough, I was not planning on it. Channels, and then it was just starting on cable service. And so I watched it. And my wife's again, because the day before I'd been flipping and found Beethoven. Well, you know, when you want to see it if it surprises you. But anyways, and I'm watching that and said, Jesus, that's hard. The next day was our wrap party, because we had to have it early because he was leaving in the middle of the week. And so we had a bowling party. We thought, yes, how much more Chinese can you get than that? So we had a bowling party, and Jackie, oh, I got a bad hamstring. You know, I've never, you know, in Wu Gong, he's never bowled in his life. He's never, he doesn't know how to bowl. The guy rolled a 257 with a bum hamstring. And, you know, we should have been tipped off when he brought his own ball. Like, he brought his own ball to Albuquerque, right? And then, you know, he throws it with that big curve like the pro guys do to put it in the pocket. And you know, all right, so he's not jumping balcony to balcony. But the physicality remains, the ability to constantly surprise you with his athleticism is still there. But you can't imagine him Why would you expect? Sure, guys, you know, action heroes trying to go on forever, but they're turning over 90% of it to their stunt people. He's turning over 28, but he's giving you the other 68%, you know, 78, whatever.
So this movie came out at a simpler time, at least I think is the easiest way to go about it in American Sino relations. Was there ever any political discussion on set? Or
No. You know, this is the kind of thing, you know, let me regress on that. And whenever I do a screening of Are We There Yet, people always say to me, so what's it like working with Ice Cube? And what they're really saying to me is, well, how does an old white Jewish guy get along with Ice Cube? And the answer is, when you're engaged in a common goal, a common purpose, all that other stuff doesn't matter. And working with Jackie, working with his crew, it was none of that mattered. We were working together. We were all focused on doing something wonderful and fun and doing it under the worst possible circumstance. It was also starting to get very cold every day in Albuquerque, which I went to school there, and I couldn't never remember, you know, waking up to 2 feet of snow the entire time I was there, but it happened during the shooting. Anyways, what's important is, you know, the differences between you aren't as important as the commonalities. And yes, I think there was a very hopeful time in the relationships between the two countries. And I've been dying, even wrote two films set in China that no one's made yet. And it seems like the door may be closing on that for a while. But, you know, I was excited by the professionalism, by the universality of the experiences and how Jackie appreciated his role and played it to the hilt with our crew. You know, that knows no bound. Kindness and generosity of spirit knows no boundaries, no geographical boundaries.
That certainly makes sense. But the film itself seems to have a slight, it seems to have a definite perspective on the intelligence community.
Really? You mean, no. No, there's absolutely not on my part any political motivation whatsoever. Every time I saw Billy Ray, I winced. No, seriously, he worked very hard and he was a very sweet guy. But I got to tell you a story. So today he comes in to arrest the villain at the very end of the movie, sweeps in. And what's the line? It's hands up or something. Everybody freeze. That's what it was. Everybody freeze. So he was like 2 hours early to set. Right. And we're not ready for you yet, Billy. Okay, I'll just get ready. And so for 2 hours, he's walking around in circles. And you see him out of the corner of your eye while we're, and he keeps going, freeze, everybody freeze, everybody freeze, everybody freeze, everybody freeze, everybody freeze, right? For 2 hours, he's doing this, right? So we go, all right, take one. Billy comes through the door. He comes through the door, and he looks up, and he goes, line?
I mean, following up on that, like, are there any good stories of George Lopez? I mean, we talk a lot about Jackie Chan.
George was doing a lot of things at the time, and he would basically just show up on certain days. I don't think he was ever there more than 2 days in a row. He was definitely working for the Obama campaign, and I think he had series and comedy dates and stuff. And so George would show up, and I was like, so what are we shooting today? Which is not what you want to hear first thing in the morning. But, you know, Bob wanted very familiar faces in those roles. He wanted people that he figured the kids didn't really know Jackie Chan. Fair enough, right?
He had a cartoon for a while. I don't know if this was
I think that was after. I think that came after.
Okay, wow, yeah.
And Bob wanted, you know, people that they saw, people from Hannah, Montana, and who are on TV every week. And that's how you get people like that. And actually, Bob cast the villain, Magnus Scheving, who his kids used to like his show that he made in, where was he? Iceland.
Iceland, yeah.
Show in Iceland. And he was the world's fittest man. So I loved the idea of getting somebody who was as genuinely as athletic as Jackie. right? And he really, you know, he's leaping off banisters. They're matching physicality, the sword fights and stuff. Great fun. There's a, hardly any, there's like no rehearsal on that. You know, it's just like, all right, you got the, got it. All right, let's go. And so it was a treat to have someone who was equally adept physically to compete against Jackie. See, I'm telling you, we really tried to get him people to fight against that were different.
One of the funniest gags in this movie for me was putting the villain in all those funny costumes. How did you resist the urge to put Jackie Chan in a Halloween costume?
He did, because very simply, you know, we were talking about the script and Halloween, he goes, "What's Halloween?" Now, I could have fooled him, but I think during the fitting, he might have caught on.
You know, you're talking about the celebrities and the stars you wanted to have as part of this cast and that Bob was putting this cast. I'm wondering, was there any consideration for a domestic Chinese audience for this movie? And did you expect it?
All right, yeah. So this is all we heard from the time that we began was we're going to have a big push in China. We're going to have a Beijing premiere. And I was all excited, and then it never happened because I think the company was starting to, if not sinking, taking on water at that point. It since went into bankruptcy and was sold two or three times and its assets sold off. And I don't even know if they're paying residuals right now. Wow. Truth. You're dealing with an independent. Get your money up front. what else can I tell you about?
Well,
this?
So one thing I'm curious about.
Let me tell you something about relativity, though, as long as we're bashing them. And my career is about over, so I'm not really worried about retribution anymore. We did not want them to see this film until the preview, until it was ready, right? And with Bob, we resisted their seeing it. And then the day before the preview, they muscle into the editing room and demand to see it. They said they're not having a preview without having seen it. And so they watched it. They never laughed once. They never smiled once. They walked out of there and called Bob and told him they didn't even want to preview it, that they thought it was garbage, et cetera, et cetera. And Bob said, just do the preview, huh? And of course, we previewed it in Westlake Village, California, near my house here, with a very unfortunately, that's when you test out there, you get a very white audience, but a good cross section of economics and stuff. And of course, we tested a 98 with the 14 and under, and a 90 with the 14 above, including moms and dads. The relativity people were dumbfounded. They were ready to jump down our throats and take control of this and whatever. And after that, they had to just shrug and move on because they were wrong. And they, believe me, wouldn't admit it. But, you know, and then at the premiere, I was chastised for not thanking the head of production who was trying to submarine us the whole time.
Another thing I was curious about, you mentioned that Jackie's reality was also not aware of Halloween, but his character is apparently a long time David Bowie, Iggy Pop fan. Did Jackie have any awareness of this?
I know. Yeah. You know, the MacGuffin, as it were, as Hitchcock would call it, the whole GBH, the whole thing is so, it's from Mars.
It's timely now, though, with the oil crisis.
I like eating the oil. I like seeing it, talking about it, and having this thing that everyone was chasing. It's a necessary evil in storytelling, but as a storyteller, it's like a rock in your shoe. Every time you take a step, it just kind of, you know, it gives you a little. Like I said, I came in late to the script. And, you know, I was able to, you know, spend a weekend with some of my guys putting in jokes that everybody hated and then got big laughs, of course, down the line. But, you know. What did Ricky Nelson say? You can't please everybody, so you got to please yourself, right?
curious what it was like working with the pig, like early on in the movie. Or I guess
you're referring to the animal, right? You know, having never worked with one, I didn't realize that they don't see very well at all. So if you lift them off the ground, they go nuts. But, you know, basically like any other animal, and believe me, I've worked with everything from elephants to tarantulas and everything in between. And I'm not kidding. Basically, if you show it food somewhere, right? And then you take it away from the food, and then you wave the food in front and run out of camera. And then you make a cut when he runs out to go for the food. And if someone scoops him up along the way, that's the shot. But it's not very complicated. You know, getting the cat to fall asleep on camera was much harder. When Jackie's serenaded singing Bao Bei, the Chinese song to the little girl to put her to sleep, does it a couple times. And took performance royalties, I think. But, so he's singing the song and the little girl's falling asleep, and we filmed the cat nodding off, right? So we had to sit there and rolling. You know, we go for like 18 minutes, right, on a 20-minute reel, and the cat's just starting to nod off, and somebody drops something, and it wakes up. Let's reload, do it again. And the same thing happened about 12 minutes in, so it's an hour to get a shot of the cat closing its eyes and going to sleep. So I'm sure people will be thrilled with that story. Okay.
Well, we're closing in on an end here, but do you have any last thoughts that you'd want to share on the film, or any, I don't know?
No, I have, I told you I've written a couple projects set in China, and I wrote them in the hopes of attracting Jackie to be in it, because working with him again would be amazing, and it was an honor and a privilege to do it once, and I should be grateful for that, but I would still love to do it again. Should the stars ever align, you know, there's few people I admire more or had a better instant collaborative instinct with. I think we complimented each other well, that I think he thought I was engaged in the production and not just trying to do and tell a story, as opposed to working, you know, what my style, you know, is like a comet. It came and it went, and I'm just glad I got to see the comet and ride it. That's a unique individual, and I bought him as a rap present. I started this by telling you, you know, how I always compared him to the silent comics. Well, growing up in China, he had never seen Chaplin or Lloyd or Keaton. And as soon as he did, he became enamored of their work and idolized them the same way I do. And I managed to find, we've all seen the picture of Harold Lloyd hanging clock, Safety Last, 1925. Well, I found the real photograph of that shot.
Wow.
and got him a copy and gave it to him as a wrap present. And he said it would find a place of honor in his home. And actually, when I went to China, I brought him a present of the collection of all of Buster Keaton's films. Wrapped in gold, in gold wrapping paper with a red ribbon. I did all my homework. and so again, it's been great just to think about these things and talk about them. And again, I would wish I could work with Mr. Jackie Chan again. Love it.
Thanks, Brian Levant. We're looking forward to his book, My Life and Toys, which is coming soon. Our final interview for the episode is with David Newman, who composed the score for The Spy Next Door. Tell us how you first got involved with The Spy Next Door project.
I'd worked with the director already. It's Brian Levant, who I'd done Jingle All the Way and the two Flintstones movies. I'd worked with Brian in the 80s, I mean, way back. And then he didn't work as much, you know, and then we did this movie in 2010. So I knew the director. I knew Brian. He's in L.A. too, so I'm sure he's hunkered down. Where are you guys?
In New York.
Sort of an epicenter, but I guess California is relatively yeah. close to Washington, so everybody has reason to be scared.
Yeah, but L.A.'s so spread out. I've hardly been out of my house for a month. You know, it's a different kind of thing. We have a place in New York, too. You know, there everybody's on top of each other.
How's that affected your work?
I mean, most of my work is at home anyway, so it really doesn't, except that, you know, all production shut down and a lot of post-production shut down. You know, I have projects going. I have an animation project, a Netflix project that's going, that's 10 episodes, about 20 minutes of music for each episode. So that'll offer that for the year. But it's going to really affect coming down the road. You know, when I'm freelance, it's not, you know, nobody's fire. You know, we're very lucky where we are and what we're able, you know, to do. So
to get to Spy Next Door, at what point did you know that Jackie Chan was involved? Was that something you were told when you were brought onto the project?
Oh, or? Yeah. No, I was involved in post-production. So the movie had been made. He was working on getting me on the movie for a while. It wasn't just a slam dunk because of some reason, whatever was going on politically. I knew it was a Jackie Chan movie, you know, acting as a, you know, kind of a house husband in a way.
What's that Michael Keaton movie?
Very odd character for Jackie.
Yeah. Mr. Mom.
Yeah.
In the post-production phase, did Jackie Chan ever have anything to say about what he might want the sound to look like?
Not really. I mean, he, I'm sure, spoke to Brian, who spoke to me. But, you know, like I said, Brian and I have worked on several movies. We were very used to working with each other, how to do it. So it wasn't like I knew it was a Jackie Chan movie, but I just approached it as a movie.
Hmm.
We actually didn't even score it. We scored it more like a kind of Bond movie-ish in a way. But, it, you know, it's funny, too. So that's what I've spent a lot of my career dealing with, is action and comedy and black comedy and comedy and drama and comedy and how to deal with it, you know, both parts of it. A lot of action in Spy Next Door.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
A lot of physical action. But it couldn't ever be heavy or, you know, we talked about stuff like that, you know, how to make a score that's exciting, but that allows an audience to laugh.
What was your background in terms of having, did you grow up on spy movies? Like, I know your brother ended up scoring some James Bond movies later on.
We grew up on the, you know, Hollywood ones. The James Bond movies were always big events. Tom and I are almost the same age. We go to the movies all the time at the west side of Los Angeles, to Westwood, where all the movies were. We saw everything. Bond movies were think of as spy movies. It all kind of comes from that, from the John Barry kind of mixture of pop music at the time and orchestral film music. That was always the reference in a spy movie. There's a little Superman in it too, though it's not a comic book movie. But, you know, he looks like one thing and he's another.
Yeah.
There's that aspect to it as well.
Yeah, the secret identity.
Yeah.
And dressing sort of badly in his secret identity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it has a lot of that. And then, you know, and then at the end you get all the full disclosure of what he's capable of doing. And but that he really does want to be, you know, he really does want to settle and have a family and all that stuff. So
were you familiar with Jackie Chan's Hong Kong movies before working on this one?
A little bit, but I can't say I was a, you know, a super fan. I certainly had friends that were. I mean, it certainly was back then a thing. A lot of people were obsessed with Jackie Chan movies. I'm sure Brian was.
Yeah, just aside from the very stunt-heavy action that was happening on screen, do you feel like that specific heritage of Jackie Chan as not just like the suave spy, but also especially in this movie, the comic character, do you feel like that played into the score?
Yeah, I mean, the score needed to allow it to happen. A lot of times in a comedy, the music needs to allow things to happen, not make things happen. Film music generally allows, especially in comedy, for the narrative and the comedy to happen. It doesn't get ahead of it. It's not, the music isn't in itself funny, quote unquote, but it needs to allow for it to be funny. But I think sometimes the music in like a movie like this, it needs to be kind of stylish in a way. And that's what allows for the comedy. You know, there's a lot of humor in Bond movies.
Yeah.
Too. Different kind of humor. There's a lot of pathos in this movie too. You know, there are kids in the movie and there's a lot to consider with the music. It's a Hollywood American movie, or at least that's the sort of genre. So you have to reference that a little bit. So you reference electric guitar, and you reference a lot of the John Barry stuff, which is kind of the syntax of this type of movie, mm-hmm. at least in the main. And then I'd say the Secret Identity part of it is more of a superhero thing, which you can also reference, which referencing is very important in film music. Mm-hmm. Being able to subtly and originally reference things so that the audience gets it quickly and is not confused by the music, even if it's in a subliminal way or that they're not aware of it. It's not distracting. It massages and helps tell the story, whatever the through line of the story is. He wants to be a homebody. That's what he wants. So that's a theme of the movie. One of it is that you get to see how skilled he is. And he comes with all that background of film work, you know, so it makes it fun to watch that.
It's the process, like, of taking these fundamentals and these callbacks, the general spy film canon, to mixing in your own creative influence or your own creative license when you're working. Yeah,
it's hard to describe because there's so little that works specifically in a movie. It's not like 90% of what you could do in a movie writing music for won't work. And I use the term work in quotes. That you write a cue for a movie, you play it for the director or the producer or whoever, you know, as you're working on it. And either it works perfectly or it just doesn't work. So mainly your process is trying to find what works. Sometimes you do have the added advantage of that it's a certain genre. Say you can use an electric guitar in a certain way, that James Bond guitar sound. So I could use a guitar, I just would use different music. I'd use music that I would use throughout the film, would reference the Bond movie. That's just an example. A scene with kids, you would score in a certain way. A love scene or a scene between people that aren't together yet, but that are getting, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You just, some movies you can be really original and you don't need to reference all that much. But these types of movies, most of the types of movies that I do or did are these movies that are peppered with comedy. They are a little bit, the goal is a little bit different. It's not to be, I'm not saying this is a pejorative at all. And I think it's very misunderstood. That's why no comedies are ever nominated for virtually none ever nominated for anything for Academy Awards. Even the film community doesn't get it, what comedy is, how difficult it is, how nuanced it is. I mean, they might look at a Preston Sturges comedy, His Girl Friday, who's that director? Howard Hawks. The screwball comedies, in the beginning when films started, comedies were thought a little more up in the hierarchy than they are now. And you can see that by the awards that go.
In the more sort of family-oriented moments of this movie, it really set a tone that very much reminded me of the tone of family movies in the early aughts, which I think you set a lot of, you know, with the Cat in the Hat and the Scooby-Doo movies.
Yeah.
What are the essential elements of that era's tone in a score for a family movie?
It is the people that did the most of those movies. They sort of set the tone of it, the comedies. It's a very postmodern, if you know what I mean. They pay attention to themselves. They reference themselves in a way. Up until 2008, 9, and 10, we were sort of still in that late 80s, 90s era. There were still films that were like this, these middle class. In other words, now a movie, okay, forget Netflix and all that. Now a movie by a studio is either, you know, like a couple of million dollars or it's $300 million. But this was a middle class movie. I mean, it wasn't like a 90s middle class movie, which would have cost $50 to $80 million. I'm sure it was more $15-20 million. But those movies took a certain kind, these comedies, the rom-coms, the family coms, all those. There was a style, I think, that was set in the late 80s and 90s. Like Home Alone, my good friend Alan Silvestri said, it's funny in a way, but I think there's some truth to it, is that we all have a song and we keep trying to get our song right. So you can generally tell an Elfman score, a Hans Zimmer score, John Williams score, Goldsmith score. If you're listening to music at all in movies and you're interested at all, you generally can tell all these composers apart. So you have to ask yourself, why is that? There's something common to that person's way of thinking about putting music in movies or just writing music in general. There's stuff that's referenced from Jingle All the Way that we did in the 90s, probably, you know, between the children and the father, the kids and the, there's a little bit of heroic stuff in it here and there. And then a lot of the Bond stuff.
Yeah.
Which, you know, which just comes from that.
But just to follow up on the idea of certain genres of movies and certain periods having these specific musical aesthetics that come with that, just based on what you're saying, I'm wondering, do you think that that's more to do with the time period, or if there are specific decades or periods in movie music, or if it really is the handful of composers out there who are doing so much work and...
I think that's was more of the latter. Is that, I mean, again, people aren't really all that interested in comedy scores, so there's not a lot of thought about it. I love them. I loved 1960s Disney scores. There's a movie called The Truth About Spring, which I think is 1960 or 61, that stars Haley Mills and her dad. And the score is magnificent. And it's just goofy. But it's pitch perfect for the movie. And then there's a movie that a young Sophia Loren and an older Clark Gable. It's called It Started in Naples. And it's Sophia Loren and Clark Gable. And it has a score by these two Italian guys because it takes place in Capri. And it's just brilliant. And I've always had a soft spot for that. And I started off doing DeVito movies, which were really funny, dark, weird movies, you know, like Throw Mama from the Train, which was a throwback to Strangers on a Train. And then his darkest one, which was The War of the Roses, which is about a divorce to the death, essentially, in a kind of Shakespearean way. A lot of what I learned about doing that came from those movies, because Throw Mama from the Train, I think, was 87. I mean, it was like a year or two after I even started scoring movies. Because I didn't write any music at all till I was 29 years old. I wanted to be a conductor, and I was playing violin. So I just decided one day that I just didn't want to, for the rest of my life, play the violin. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but and I started working. And early on, I got Throw Mom from the Train, and he actually loved the score to Critters, which is probably, I'm not a huge fan of that score, but it doesn't sound to me like anything. That score. That sounds like an original score, probably to its detriment in a way. But Danny just loved it and put it in, tempted all over Throw Mom from the Train. Of course, I used nothing like that because I used Bernard Herrmann as a reference. But Bernard Herrmann's music isn't funny. I mean, it doesn't allow for much humor.
But I mean, it does in some Hitchcock movies, though, doesn't it? It sometimes subsides to give moments of humor. Or I guess the music fades in those moments.
It isn't about humor. It's
his Fahrenheit 451 is funny Bernard, too, I think.
I haven't seen that, so I don't know. Anyway, I'm not a huge Bernard Herrmann person like everybody else is. I mean, I get it. I think he's almost a better concert composer than a film composer. But anyway, but not to say that, you know, North by Northwest is brilliant. I mean, they're brilliant. There's brilliant. I'm not wholeheartedly, but like I wrote a cue. The main title of Throw Mom from the Train is Billy Crystal having writer's block. Mm-hmm. He's not really saying anything. He's just sitting there, and they keep step at it. You know, cut editing, and I wrote a cue that was more like Bernard Herrmann and DeVito, and it was DeVito's first film, and he just didn't like it. He didn't know why he didn't like it, but he didn't like it. We hadn't worked together, and he's not very loquacious about, we just didn't know what to do. So I started to figure out, you know, it's just not allowing it to be funny. So I went back and I used the same musical material. I just added some humor, and mainly I added weirdness. Like I started adding a bunch of toy instrument percussion, and I added a toy piano, and then I made it sort of Bernard Herrmann, because it needed to be dark and weird, but it needed to allow it to be funny. And that's sort of where I learned a lesson on that. It was much better the way it, for my career, was much better the way it went down than if I'd solved it initially, because then it was like I was a magician. I changed it so radically without really changing the notes, the music. In essence. And then I learned about something about films. You have to work on it. And not everything works that you think is going to work. And even you need to allow for humor without pushing the humor. Now, sometimes you can push the humor. Like in the movie I was stating, it started in Naples. They keep playing Yankee Doodle Dandy. in this sort of Italian outdoor band music way while he's kind of marching up and down the street. So there's no dialogue or anything, but because it's in the midst of this beautiful, magical, early synth vibe, but it's an orchestra score, but it has all this vibraphone that is vibrating and it's all magical on this magical island in Italy. And, you know, it just works. But like you were saying, like the late 80s, 90s kind of set the tone for what the genre would be for The Spy Next Door. And I would consider The Spy Next Door a genre film. It's kind of a rom-com film and an action comedy film at the same time.
Because we mentioned a little bit Jingle All the Way. I'm just wondering how many parallels there were between these movies, because they do seem to be centered around both like an action star going to do a romantic comedy, family comedy role.
Right. I did a fair amount of those. Again, it's difficult for an action star to do this. You know, you just have to take it carefully with the score. In terms of what I've been saying, you have to tread really lightly with this stuff, but you have to do something as well, because what's the point of having music if you're not doing any kind of commenting, sort of musical vertical referencing of things that, you know, that music brings to a Hollywood, you know, Hollywood movie. But when it's an action star, you know, it's tricky. I thought Jackie Chan was charming in this movie. I thought Arnold was charming in Jingle All the Way, though I thought it was more difficult in Jingle All the Way than it was in The Spy Next Door, because just I knew a lot more of Arnold Schwarzenegger's movies because it was such a big action star when, you know, we were all going out to the movies.
Did Billy Ray Cyrus play any role in the music?
Was there a Billy Ray Cyrus song? Not to
there is it. Was there? He's musical.
Oh, yeah. No, it was just me and Brian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't think there was a whole lot of money rolling around for the film.
Mm-hmm.
I know we didn't score it in Los Angeles. I forget where we did score it, but it was off-site for sure.
Not in Hong Kong, though?
No. In 2010, there weren't that many places to go like there are now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Early on, I did a Disney animated film called The Brave Little Toaster.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's a fantastic
great movie.
That we scored in Japan. I did just do a movie called Pets United with Constantine Film that was funded by China, but it's not distributed in the United States, at least yet. That's the only other relationship I've had with China. Pets United opened in October. What happens in October in China?
I believe there was a Communist Party meeting, so that's one
thing. There's some huge cultural event, or it's like that Pets United was, I think, the only movie shown for a week in China in October 19th.
Just wow.
Pretty incredible.
You know, I don't know if that's true.
Sure.
You know,
I'd like to believe it.
Thank you, Brian Levan and David Newman, for being on the show. You can check out David's latest work in Pets United, Green Eggs and Ham on Netflix, and Steven Spielberg's upcoming West Side Story. I think that's it for this episode.
Our original music comes from Elliot Saltmarsh and Yehuda of Fist with a PH, and our art comes courtesy of Jay Castro.
Follow us on Twitter at ChinaFilmPod, like the Uproar in the Studio Facebook page, and if you can afford it, we would really appreciate it if you could contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com/uproarinthestudio. We, like Jackie Chan in this movie, are trying to take down dictators and make it so only Russia gets to export oil. If you feel like it, have some thoughts or suggestions, email us at uproarinthestudio@gmail.com.
Next week, we'll be talking about Little Big Soldier. But before we leave you this week, we just want to share some wisdom from the chairman.
To read too many books is harmful. We'll see you in a week.